We'll call the meeting of Climate and Energy to order. Welcome, everyone. We've got a few bills on the agenda today, but before that, we will maybe look for a motion to move the minutes from March 7th. Representative Kraft, have you had a chance to look at the meeting minutes from March 7th?
Madam Chair, I have, and I move their approval.
Any discussion to the meeting minutes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Okay. First on the agenda, we have, let's see, House File 2147. Representative Herr, I believe, is here to join us today.
Yeah.
Welcome to committee, Representative Herr. And I will move House File 2147 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Herr, will you tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Chair Acom and members of the committee. This House File 2147 authorizes funding for critical microgrid research training in Minnesota. The bill before you is requesting funding to for the Center for Microgrid Research at the University of St. Thomas from the Renewable Development Account. And today I do have a couple of testifiers here, Dr. Don Weinkoff, and the Dean of School of Engineering at St. Thomas, and Dr. Mohammed Kabbalan, Professor and Director of the Center for Microgrid Research. And the two of them can talk more to the specifics of the grid. But, you know, I had a couple of things prepared here that I wanted to talk about this particular facility. But what I just want to say is that this facility actually sits right in, you know, in the middle of St. Paul. I had a chance to go and tour it. I think a number of members here got a chance to go and tour it as well. And I watched the way the facility was being used by those who were coming to test it as a testing facility. I watched the training center in which students were working. The day I was there, there happened to be students who were actually learning and being taught, what they can do within this particular facility. And I was really impressed by the fact that what we've been able to invest in this microgrid research at St. Thomas has yielded us more than I think I could have ever anticipated. That in the first year, in the funding that we were given, and I have those numbers on here. I just want to share that really quick with all of you, that we were able to, you know, the first $5.4 million brought in $11 million of federal funds that have been committed, and that this additional funding today could bring an additional $25 million from the Fed. And I think that it's very rare that we find situations in which the funding that we have go directly to Minnesotans, but then we're able to bring in additional dollars that will impact actually all of this, not just our state, but the country. And so I'm really supportive of this particular project, and I do have testifiers here to speak today. I wanted to just address one small thing that I know there's been some confusion around the language and how it was written about the actual dollar amount that is being requested. And I just want the committee to be aware that, you know, some of that language that in the funding that's being asked for covers additional appropriations that were given in other bienniums, and that we are very open to actually having conversations on how do we change this language to better meet the needs of what this committee might need to see, and also to create language that clarifies the dollar amounts that are being asked today. So with that, Madam Chair, I would love to turn it over to my testifiers and have them give a little bit of background on this particular project.
Great. Thank you, Representative Herr. So we will reach out Dr. Don Weinkoff and Dr. Mohammed Kabbalan. Welcome to committee. And if you could state your name for the record and go ahead and proceed.
Well, certainly. My name is Don Weinkoff, and I'm the Dean of Engineering here at the University of St. Thomas. And with me today is Dr. Mahmoud Kabbalan, who is one of the faculty members in the School of Engineering, but is also the director of the Center for Microgrid Research. And I also just like to add as a plus here, just last month, Dr. Kabbalan was awarded the prestigious National Science Foundation a Careers Award for his work in microgrid research and his systems technologies. So I just want to spend just a couple of minutes reintroducing this proposal to the group. But first, maybe there are some people who might not quickly understand what the School of Engineering is and what it means for the state of Minnesota. And with that, I would just want to just quickly familiarize with you with the School of Engineering. You might be surprised to learn that one in six students at the University of St. Thomas, studies in the School of Engineering. And last year, we graduated, we awarded over 400 bachelor's and master's degrees in the various areas of civil engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, computer engineering, software engineering, and even the data sciences. So we are a workforce engine for the state of Minnesota. And we're continuing to invest in that workforce engine. We are just in the process of constructing the new Scheneker Center on our campus, which will expand our science and engineering laboratories, classrooms, and collaboration spaces by more than 50%. So quickly turning to microgrids, they are critical components of our modern electric grid that will enable a resilient and reliable power supply as we transition to larger and larger percentages of renewable energy sources. So when we last sat in front of this committee via Zoom 2 years ago, we pledged to design and build out a hands-on, real-world scale, world-class facility for the state of Minnesota through the RDA funds and use those to develop and educate students and attract significant national partners to Minnesota to conduct microgrid research and development. And so today, if I could advance the slide, we are in this early stage, 1 year into its development. As we pledged, we're already attracting significant national partners. In fact, we are in the process of, in the next few days, of finalizing an $11 million research contract with the Department of Defense. That's $11 million of funds that will largely be spent here in the state of Minnesota, educating our power systems workforce and engaging students in microgrid systems integration, battery storage, controls technologies, everything you're learning about what's the future of our future grid will look like. I would like to highlight that there's a $4.1 million ask for new expansion of this facility. So in addition to the $11 million, with this expansion, we feel that we're going to be able to track significantly larger amounts of funding from outside of the state of Minnesota. And we will use this funding to really design unique capabilities that are almost unparalleled in the nation. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Kavalam, to talk about a little bit about the facility, and then I'll close out.
Thank you. So, good afternoon. Good afternoon. As Dean Weinkopf shared, we are building something truly special here in Minnesota. I am very proud of St. Thomas's stewardship of the RDA funds to date, and I am excited to share what is possible with additional investment. With initial state funding and further investment from St. Thomas, the center has developed into one of the premier microgrids hands-on research and educational facilities in the nation. It is truly a unique facility with the potential to create incredible and relevant research and workforce development opportunities. In case anyone is asking what a microgrid actually is, let me quickly explain. So if you can look at slide 3 there, microgrids are essential components of our future smart electrical grid, and they are much more than a simple backup system. Microgrids are local energy systems that can integrate multiple energy sources and, very importantly, operate interactively with the main grid and separate from the main grid when the grid is out. A microgrid can seamlessly transition between those two operating conditions in a matter of seconds. As the grid gets more congested, strained, and even disrupted, microgrids have a great role to play to maintain the stability of our electric supply. But just like the grid, microgrids themselves are complex systems to operate and control. So you're seeing up on slide 4 is a schematic of our microgrid facility today. It is a versatile system for evaluation of wind, solar, electric vehicles, battery storage, generators, and the array of controls that manage this complex system necessary for the operation of any resilient microgrid. The facility translates to hands-on, at-scale education for our engineering students, training opportunities for our current workforce, as well as testing and validation of new equipment in our available plug-in test bays as new products emerge in the market. To give you some sense of the scale, while some research programs might have labs that could power something on a scale of 1 to 2 households, the system at the center would be able to power up to 1,000 homes. When we appeared before this committee 2 years ago, which now seems forever, given COVID, we promised that through the RDA investment, the center will attract significant national interest and research collaborations to Minnesota. As Dr. Weinkauf mentioned, we are seeing that vision manifest in the current level of research grant funding from federal sources. And if we can expand the facility's capabilities through this request, we are in early discussions of an additional $25 million federal investment to develop microgrid pilot systems here in the state of Minnesota, including a national model at the Minnesota National Guard's facility at Camp Ripley. And let's go to slide 5. Finally, I would like to draw your attention to the summary of our partnerships on slides 6 through 8 in your packet that we have actively built through our work at the center, including corporate, national, and local institutions. Several of our partners are here today and have expressed their strong support for the work that we are doing. Dean Weinkauf?
Well, thank you, Chair Akam and Representative Herr. And members of the committee, we want to thank you again for your time and attention to this request today. And as the state works to achieve its carbon-free by 2040 goals, we believe it's critical that the state commit to developing the technologies and the training that will be essential for a sustainable, reliable, resilient grid system. And microgrids will play an undeniably vital role in achieving those goals. So through the RDA, Minnesota has taken a significant lead in this space, and it will be significantly strengthened by further investment. And we urge your support for HF 2147, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you or any members of the committee may have.
We have one more person to testify. Can you do that? Okay, great. And then we'll turn to member questions. So next we're going to hear from Erica Schmidt. Welcome to committee, Ms. Schmidt. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Akam. Thanks. Good afternoon, Chair Akam and committee members. My name is Erica Schmidt. I work as a distribution system engineer at Kinexus Energy, Minnesota's largest member-owned electric cooperative. I grew up in Maplewood and graduated from Roseville High School, where my favorite subject was physics. From there, I majored in math and physics at Lawrence University, transferring to the University of Minnesota to major in electrical engineering. I knew I wanted to work in the power industry, so I applied for a role at Kinexus Energy. After 2 years of gaining on-the-job experience at Kinexus Energy, I decided I wanted to learn more. In spring of 2019, I applied to the graduate-level program at the Center for Microgrid Research, interested in electric vehicles and power systems. The training I received from Dr. Cavallon and his colleagues at the center has been extremely valuable in my work and professional advancement. As you heard previously, Kinexus is now in our 5th year of operating a 15 megawatts of battery storage coupled by microgrid with 10 megawatts of solar. This application, as well as numerous other distribution design elements in our grid, helps Kinexus maintain electric service reliability for the 5th year in a row in the top 5% of all utilities nationwide, while also maintaining competitive rates. The accelerating energy transition requires recognition of the unique regional asset we have in Dr. Cavallon and his colleagues, as well as their dedication and skill to inspire and train engineers like me. For Minnesota and all utilities, advanced workforce development is a critical component of our changing grid. Thank you for your consideration of
HF 2147. Thank you,
Michelle.
I appreciate that. First questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to maybe the folks from St. Thomas or
you don't want me to answer the question.
Well, if you too, yeah, you can hang out. Yeah. You know, just kind of looking at, so just wanted to see, so the university just started this program in the development center. How much RDA or ratepayer funds from Xcel have you gotten in the past, and what is the, you know, so you're asking $4.1 million of ratepayer money in this bill. Mm-hmm. Like, do you have plans in the future? You know, kind of where is that financing coming from? How's that work?
Well, thank you, Chairwoman Akam and Representative. We certainly believe that we are talking about the extent of the capital investment in this center. This is not going to be going into the operating budget. We're not going to be coming back asking for more and more operating funds. So we received $2.1 million in 2013 to start the center, and we received an authorization of $5.4 in 21. And as we have discussed with our partners, really from that point in 21 where we realized the potential of this center, basically is if we could take it to this level, we are talking about something not only unique to the region, but certainly unique to the nation. And as Dr. Koblon pointed out, if we could achieve this new investment that we are talking about demonstrating at the University of St. Thomas in terms of its grid integration, what we're really talking about is multiple interconnects to the XL grid, that if we could demonstrate the microgrid under those conditions, and then translate that to the pilot programs that the Department of Defense is considering, we're talking about an additional $25 million of investment from outside of the state into the state for not only education and training of our students like Erica, but also investment in these pilot programs that are going to be distributed throughout the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a good answer. Just to kind of flesh that out, you know, obviously, you know, we understand there's, you know, I'm guessing you're going to probably be doing battery research. You're going to be doing solar, wind. Are there any technologies not currently being researched in Minnesota that, I mean, are you going to be opening any new cans? Or are you only going to be using existing things that we've already kind of are out in the marketplace in Minnesota?
Well, we're certainly not developing new distributed energy resources. Where the center, the secret of the center, the secret sauce of the center is the integration of those distributed energy resources. So if someone comes in with a new fuel cell or a new photovoltaic system or a new diesel generator set, how does that interact with the grid? How does that interact? Someone comes in with a new battery storage system. And so the center is designed for really inviting our partners to come in with their new distributed energy resources to literally plug in. If you come and visit the center, which we would encourage you to do, it's pretty impressive. These are the largest plugs you will ever see. You will be asked to bring your equipment in with a plug which is about the size of a pancake, plug it into the grid, and then we will be able to demonstrate how it interacts with other elements of the grid. How does PV interact with your battery system? How does the diesel generator set interact with your new battery storage system? And that's what this center is really, the versatility of the center is its uniqueness and its ability for system integration.
And if I may add, just maybe to pull back your attention to this slide, even for such a small system, you're looking at multiple equipment vendors. So that you can't really go out and buy a microgrid. You buy different devices from different vendors. Typically, those devices are designed to operate by themselves. So the integration piece is one of the biggest challenges to address. So that's one of the focuses that we're addressing is how do you integrate equipment from 10 to 15 vendors to actually operate seamlessly. And we're talking seamlessly in a fraction of seconds to react to grid disruptions or different operating conditions.
Representative, any follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You know, there's, you know, obviously in this space, there's a lot of different developments going on, a lot of new technologies. You know, one of the biggest things that, you know, I've read lately is the Department of Defense, and it sounds like that's, you know, main impetus behind this is U.S. government and DOD looking to integrate and develop, you know, some self-sufficiency when it comes to their own power systems within their bases, which is important. But there's also technology, you know, in that, you know, the micronuclear world. You know, do you guys feel that this would be able to help support that potential for development and or integration? And are there any limitations that you would see by the state that would keep you from some of that research?
So. Thank you, Chair Akam. Sorry, my apologies. Thank you, Rep. I personally would love to explore that, right? Rolling in a micronuclear reactor into St. Paul, you know, we're going to have to discuss that with the safety safety inspection at the city, right? So from my perspective, I look at it from an agnostic perspective. Whatever the source that you provide for me, I will integrate that into my microgrid and make it operational. So I'm not really concerned about what the source is. That's where the uniqueness is that it's future-proof enough that whatever device comes online, that we will work on integrating that with the microgrid and learning those lessons so we can share them with our partners. So that's where that the strength of what we're building here is.
Madam Chair?
Representative.
Yeah, and just to the researchers, you know, have the discussions with the DOD partners with that potential $25 million. Has that technology been part of the conversations as far as how they want to utilize you as a partner?
Mm-hmm. So, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. So the Army came up with a goal of having every single installation be a microgrid by 2035, which is 12 years from now. They, frankly, don't know how to get there. And that's where our partnership comes in, because we are learning things on the ground, building stuff. It's as real as it gets. So that's where that partnership with Erdex started. That's where they reached out. They visited us. They saw our capabilities, and the partnership started and flourished into that first $11 million, and now we're looking at $25 million. There are also other discussions about using micro-nuclear reactors up in Alaska, and potentially that might be another avenue of research down the line for us as well with them.
And just one final follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I just appreciate that. And I think, you know, there's some things that this committee could do to help bona fide some of that research to not make sure that these things are, regardless of you, from an agnostic, as the words were used by the testifiers, to the power supply. And if it can be proven in other places, there's no reason why we shouldn't allow that same research and potential impetus and distribution here in Minnesota. You know, one of the things that, you know, I would argue is, you know, there's a lot of things going on with our grid, and that's one of the veiled things that we're hearing from the military folks is that, you know, as we continue to tinker by, you know, state by state, different regulations, different rules, you know, the military and the Department of Defense understands the fragility of our grid, and they understand they don't want to be left in the dark when it comes to rolling blackouts. That's why they're doing this, in response to what we're doing in this room as well. So just keep that in mind.
Thank you. You said Groffler, right?
I did.
Okay, thank you, Venture. Sorry. The testifiers, one of the success stories about microgrid nationally is during Hurricane Sandy, Princeton University situation. Are you guys familiar with that incident?
I was on the East Coast when that happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could you just take just a few minutes to explain to the members of the committee that situation and why so many, kind of the good that came from that, why people are... Just talk about, I don't think people are familiar with, most people are familiar with that story.
So
I think that'll be really informative for us to hear. I just want to make sure that we're keeping an eye on time, and we do have two other bills. But Dr. Kablan, if you want to respond briefly, that would be great.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Akim. Thank you, Rep. I was actually doing my PhD at Villanova University when Sandy hit and did that massive, impressive 90-degree turn. So the grid was... the transmission and some of the distribution lines were taken out, so the grid kind of, you know, went away. What a lot of those locations, like Princeton University, were able to separate from the grid and keep the lights on campus. And when the grid came back in a week or two, they re-engaged with the grid connected to it. So that's where that power of the micro, it's not simply a backup generator that kicks in when the grid goes away. You're always running it in parallel with the grid, interactively with the grid. If you sense something that's going on with the grid, you separate from it, you keep the lights on, and when the grid comes back, you can reconnect to it. So it can be a neighborhood, it can be a university hospital, university, or a hospital campus as well.
Thank you, so, thank you, Madam Chair. Yep, and to the testifier. So again, there's these iconic photos during the blackout where you just saw swaths of black and then islands of lit up areas that were able to maintain their electricity. Because primarily substations were flooding during the storm surge, so everyone got knocked out except for the microgrids. My question is that the reason why those were successful is because they had dispatchable energy sources within their microgrid that they could turn on and off. For your guys' microgrid, what dispatchable energy sources do you have right now? And going forward, what dispatchable energy sources do you look to deploy? And by dispatchable, obviously, that does not include anything that's storage-related because that runs out. So what would be the, again, what do you have now and what do you have going forward, do you imagine for?
So right now we have, I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. So right now we have 50 kilowatts diesel, 50 kilowatts solar, and about 125 kilowatts energy storage. The expansion, we're looking at, like I said, all different types of sources. So we're going to look at diesel, natural gas, including renewable energy, solar, wind, all of those aspects, and see how they can all integrate together. Dispatchable sources are extremely important. That's very true. But you can't also rely on a dispatchable source being there 24/7 in case of an emergency. If you start to couple different technologies together, then you can reap more benefits. If you have a diesel generator running and you have a solar with it, well, that diesel generator, instead of it running 24/7 at 24 hours at full capacity, you tie it with solar, and maybe now you can run that diesel generator with the same capacity for 3 or 5 days. So now you start to reap those benefits from combining different sources together.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's a very good point, and diversification is always strengthened, but we should be understanding the project before us today that we're looking to have funded would be illegal in 2040 under the carbon free bill. And that's something that people need to understand. They won't be able to use diesel. They won't be able to use, not without purchasing renewable energy credits. So, thank you.
Thank you for that. Last question to Representative Kraft before we turn it back to the author of the bill for a final wrap.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, the testifier raised some of the points that I wanted to raise. I'm very excited to see this bill. I became familiar with microgrids about a year ago through some podcast work that I do. Some things that are going on in California as they're seeing more grid issues because of climate issues that are happening out there. And so I think this is a really exciting area for us in Minnesota to be leading on. So thank you for the bill.
Great. Then any final words to Representative Kerr?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for hearing the bill today. And it sounds like the committee seems very interested in this project, and we hope for your support. I did just want to address a couple of things really quickly in that. You know, this is why we have to invest in such an asset like this, because not only is this a microgrid research really aligned with the purposes that we want when we talk about clean energy, but that there is no entity more well-positioned to integrate new technologies or train essential workers. And this is why we need this, is that different developments and new technologies are constantly occurring within this particular industry. And to be able to have a facility that can actually test those and integrate them is really critical in us knowing, you know, are these technologies and developments, you know, are they going to work? And I also wanted to state that, you know, and I'm not an expert at this, but I do know that, you know, our universities are extremely smart and way smarter than all of us. And that should they no longer be able to use diesel, I think they are smart enough to know they can switch to other sources like hydrogen. And so the work that we are doing here as a committee and as a state, and the good that we're doing to try to have a cleaner environment, that we can accommodate that here. And that's not going to prevent this work from continuing to move forward. So I ask for this committee support, and I would ask for you to renew the motion to consider this bill for possible inclusion.
Thank you. With that, the bill is laid over. Thank you to the testifiers and to the work that you've done.
Thank you.
Next, we will hear House File 2493 from Representative Kraft. Welcome to committee, Representative Kraft. Would you like to move your bill?
Would thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 2493 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Great, and I believe you have an author or a DE1.
I do have a DE1, which I would move the DE1 and. That doesn't change the substance of the bill, but it makes some technical corrections to the language. It gets in the form that I want to be considered.
Okay. Any discussion to the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Mm-hmm. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the DE is adopted. So, Representative, please tell us about House File 2493 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm happy to be carrying House File 2493 that creates a supplemental grant program to reduce energy burden for low-income households in Minnesota. Energy burden is the percentage of gross household income spent on energy costs. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, the national average energy burden for low-income households is 8.6%, three times higher than for non-low-income households, which is estimated at 3%. In Minnesota, it's a problem everywhere, but even more so in greater Minnesota, where almost one in three counties has an average energy burden of 5% or higher. So there's two main reasons I'm excited about this bill. The primary one is that it uses some of our surplus to help lower income households deal with energy burden, because no one should have to choose between heating or cooling their home and providing for their family. And second, the program has a nice tie-in with our weatherization program, and that the same application form is used. So there's the potential of providing both immediate assistance and weatherization to reduce energy usage and costs longer term. So mechanically, the bill provides funding to supplement the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, from the federal government. During the pandemic, states received supplemental LIHEAP assistance. This has now ended, but the need is not. And a letter from the organizations that locally administer the program emphasizes the continuing need among the elderly, disabled, and families with children at home. This bill increases the income threshold of the program from 50% of state median income to 60%, and it makes the program available year-round as opposed to just during winter months. It's emphasizing to try to reach more families, not necessarily increasing amounts to households already receiving grants. The funding that we're asking for is a $100 million one-time appropriation to be spread over 5 years that can support an additional 18,000 households per year. And at this point, my partner in this bill is I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Falk from the Citizens Utility Board.
Welcome to committee, Ms. Lovinson. Yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, members. I'm Annie Levinson Falk, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota, a nonprofit consumer advocate for Minnesota utility consumers. We brought forward this bill, as Representative Kraft said, to respond to the serious issues that Minnesotans have been facing related to the cost of energy. The bill provides a one-time appropriation of state funding to supplement the funding that's received every year from the federal government through the Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, to allow the program to serve more families and to stay open through the summer months. At CUB, it's really difficult when somebody calls us in June because their utility service is about to be shut off, and we have to tell them that there's no assistance available. Sometimes people, you know, didn't apply during the winter months because they weren't aware of the program, or we talked with people who thought their application was good to go and then found out too late that there was a paperwork error because it's a pretty complicated application. So we usually tell people at that point, you know, talk to your family, see if there are local houses of worship or food banks or charities like that that might be able to help you out. And when they've exhausted those options, then the conversation shifts to something more like, well, you need, you know, it might be time to think about where else you can stay. And for renters, that can often mean losing their housing on a permanent basis. As you're well aware, fuel prices have been elevated for everyone, and the costs have especially been felt by people who use heating oil. If anyone here drives a diesel vehicle, you're aware that those costs, I mean, they've come down some, but they remain quite high. And even under normal economic circumstances, energy costs are higher in rural areas and on tribal nations. Minnesotans are feeling these costs. Residential customers owe, on average, twice as much on their utility bills as they did at this time 4 years ago. The need is great, and the current energy assistance program, as helpful as it is not keeping up. So this bill will help. It proposes to use a bit of the state supplement to send it back to families to help with those high energy costs. As Representative Kraft said, it provides assistance through an existing program, so there's no new administrative structures that need to be stood up. It would allow the program to be open through the summer to help with cooling costs or shutoff notices that folks are dealing with in the summer months. And it allows the program to consistently serve households up to 60% of state median. Usually the federal funds are at 50%. That can vary from year to year, and that's just a confusion for folks that fall in that middle range. And as Representative Kraft said, you know, energy assistance is
it's a kind of a Band-Aid. It helps people address an immediate need, but it also connects people with permanent solutions for affordability. So it connects them with weatherization assistance. It also opens up eligibility for utility affordability programs that can ensure that bills are consistent, a consistent portion of a household's income, and most Minnesotans are served by a utility that offers a program like that. We did learn today that there are some concerns with the administrative and outreach costs in the bill. This bill does propose outreach spending that could be up to 3% higher than under the federal funding, and that the intent there was to put an emphasis on reaching communities that are not being well served by the existing program. But learning that there are concerns with that, I think that's certainly something that we could address down the road. We're happy to talk about that and consider changes there. And I also just wanted to note, if members, if you're reading the DE, there is one section that has an error that will also need to be fixed. In the very last paragraph, that's section 2, paragraph B2, the intent is to say that outreach funds will prioritize organizations that can reach those underserved communities, but not that it would be limited to those organizations. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'd be happy to address any questions at the appropriate time.
Thank you for your testimony. Let's see, we have a few others on the list. Next up is Lisa Drew. And after that, I guess Ms. Rosa Pop is next after that. So welcome to committee, Ms. Drew. Please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Lisa Drew, and I am the Community Development Director at TRICAP, Tri-County Action Program. TRICAP is the energy assistance provider in the central Minnesota counties of Benton, Sherburn, and Stearns County. In addition to those which are our primary service areas, we also provide the energy assistance program in Morrison County. Our administrative offices are located in Waite Park, and as I mentioned, for a number of our services, we go beyond our designated areas of Benton, Sherburn, and Stearns County. Across all of our programs, every year we serve between 13 and 15,000 families. And the urban, across our service area, the urban population makes up 60% and the rural makes up 40%. By age group, seniors 65 and over make up 40% of that rural population. As the energy assistance provider in Stearns, Benton, Sherburn, and Morrison County last year, we served 6,975 families. 40% of those were seniors age 65 and above. This year, we're finding that the grant sizes are smaller than last year, and the income eligibility is at 50% of the median state median income instead of 60%, which is what it was last year. So what that means is, as of March 7th, the energy assistance grants that have been paid out in our service area this year are about $2.3 million. Last year, it was over $5 million at that same time. At this point in time, our crisis applications are up 20% over last year. And in some cases, the need for crisis assistance is happening at the same time as they're applying for their primary heat grant. And this is germane to my point about the rural population, because when we think about delivered fuels, with a minimum primary grant amount of $200, households and families aren't even able to get one fuel delivery without combining their primary grant with their crisis grant, and the crisis grant can go up to $1,500. This can make it very difficult for families trying to meet their basic needs. When we combine this increased cost in terms of heating, along with the other inflation and higher costs that these families are experiencing. TRICAP supports House File from Representative Kraft, as we believe that it will provide additional funding to help assist people with their heating costs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Next, we have Rosa Tock. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Happy.
Buenas tardes, good afternoon, Chair Alcom and Ecom, sorry, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rosa Tock, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. The Council is a state agency in the executive branch tasked to advise on policy and legislation that pertains and is beneficial to Latino Minnesotans. I am here to testify in strong support of this bill. During the council listening sessions in the community last year, in preparation for this legislative session, we heard many stories from youth and their families about real financial hardships that they are still experiencing, and many of these difficulties are a result of still recovering from the pandemic crisis and from the rise of prices of food and other basic services. As we know, fuel and the natural gas prices remain volatile, and this bill will help low-income families with the current costs of energy, not only during the fall and winter, but as the Representative Kraft indicated, also during the summer, especially nowadays when they tend to be much hotter, as we all have experienced lately. Also, qualifying for this program may allow someone to qualify for other assistance, for instance, to insulate their homes or replace their furnace. This bill puts focus on outreach to underserved communities and also will help to close racial disparities that we know affect our state and also all of our communities statewide. In the recent past, our council has partnered with the Department of Commerce to inform Latino households about the energy assistance program. Should this bill be considered, the council looks forward to supporting the department and other organizations with outreach to make sure that these services and programs go to more households, which is the intention of this bill. For this and many other reasons, which were raised by Representative Kraft and Annie and the previous testifier, I urge you to support and vote in favor of this proposal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kraft, for bringing this bill today. You know, I guess where I'll start digging in on it, and just so I can get some clarity on it, I was going through and just trying to read up how much of the $100 million that we're putting in here is going to actually be used to help people. And I added up that between all this other stuff, there's 10% to administer, another 2.5%, and then 8%. So if I do that correctly, is about over $20 million that's not even going to be used for assistance, but 20%.
And as I'm looking through, I think if you're looking in the appropriations, maybe like the author of the bill, but I think that 2.5% might be part of the 10%, but in Representative Kraft. Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Igo, yes, that's 2.5% is part of the 10, so it's the total is 18.
Okay.
Representative Igo.
Thank you. And then do you have any of the partners where you think this 8% for the unnamed organizations, the only reason I bring it up, and this is the third time I've brought it up today, is, you know, with the OLA doing so many reports into making sure we don't have money walk out the door and disappear here in the state of Minnesota, do we have any way of reporting this to know that this money is not going to get used fraudulently?
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Igo, I'm actually going to ask my Ms. Levinson-Paul here to talk about the process that is in place.
Ms. Levinson-Paul.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Akam and Representative Igo. This outreach and administration follows the same framework as is done with the federal funding. So I think probably some of those organizations, maybe many of them, would be the same. And that's done through Department of Commerce. I'm sure that's reported on the federal level. But I think you make a good point that if there's something different going on, maybe there's some extra reporting that should be included in that.
Representative Igo, and but actually, is there reporting within the bill on
220 to 222?
So, Representative Igo.
Is Department of Commerce here?
I believe they are.
There we go.
Welcome to committee. Mr. Kelly, please state your name for the record.
Hi, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm John Kelly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce.
So thank you for coming up here real quick. So the question, in looking at the bill, there is reporting based on, like, household information, but I guess the reporting I'm looking for clarification on is that stated in the bill, the 8.5, up to 8%, excuse me, for the outreach to unnamed organizations and whatnot. So is that going to fall under your purview in the Department of Commerce?
Mr. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative Igoa, yes. We work with 28 different service providers across the state, as well as utilities, to administer the low-income heating assistance program. And we would follow the same stringent requirements and everything else for the federal dollars as we would with state dollars if this program was to go into law.
Thank you for following up with me on that. I really do appreciate it. I guess closing remarks to this, I'll let someone else ask a question. You know, this is a concern that I started raising over a year ago when we were talking about fuel prices being out of control. I had constituents this November who still have fuel oil in northern Minnesota over $5 a gallon for a fill-up. That's, you know, if you have a 500-gallon tank, that's $2,500. It's good to see that we can do programs like this, but another way that we can offset this is actually investing in American energy and realizing that we're going to need carbon-based fuels to keep greater Minnesota warm, and that should be the other talking point of this bill. Thank you.
And with that, we're going to go on to the next. We've got 4 more questions, and we need to be done with this bill by 4 o'clock, so I just want us to be thoughtful. Representative Swazinski.
Madam Chair, just a general question, too. Just from a verification, one of the testifiers talked about how they have to stack the emergency funding, and that it's my understanding this $100 million won't necessarily go to any folks that already qualify or in, but it actually expands the program up the income vein. Is that correct?
Representative Pratt?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, part of this is aimed to expand, but it doesn't restrict that it can't go to folks that are getting it today. And Ms. Levinson-Falk might be able to comment.
Chair Ickelman, Representative Swazinski, I think probably the majority of people that would receive grants under this supplemental funding would qualify under the federal funds, too. The federal funds only reach about 20-ish percent of the families that would qualify, so there's still a lot more folks that aren't getting support from that.
So, Madam Chair, this doesn't it expands it a little bit, but mostly it'll just go to those same 20%?
Chair Akam and Representative Swazinski, it's prohibited from going to those same people. So if you receive a grant from the federal funding, you can't then get another grant from the state funding. And it even says in here that the priority is on reaching more households and not just increasing those grant amounts. It's to reach more. I think it would reach more of the folks that would fall under that, the same, you know, the 50% from the federal, but not the same households.
And then, Madam Chair, is that, you know, obviously this replaces income for folks. That do you have, as a taxpayer that receives these grants, do you report these as income when you do your income tax?
Chair Akam, Representative, I don't know. I see Mr. Kelly shaking his head, but I don't know about the tax side.
I think Ms. Levinson Falk on record. Ms. Levinson Falk said the money went directly to the utilities. That's what I heard her say.
Yep. But Madam Chair, I mean, this supplements, I mean, at the end of the day, this supplements income. So if you incur a bill as an individual, you know, I think that's just maybe a failure of the tax code that this should be tracked. As, you know, income replacement, because that's essentially what it's doing, because otherwise you would have to go out and make that money. If someone pays a bill on your behalf, you know, like, that's considered income in all other aspects of business. And it seems like we should probably, as a whole, be looked at from a perspective of maybe this should go to tax committee, because potentially this is something that we're not looking at, because we always consistently hear that, well, you know, we have folks in lower income levels, but if you're receiving this consistently on a consistent basis, this could be thousands of dollars for an individual family, and that's not necessarily be reporting, but it should be as income.
Representative Kraft, did you want to?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, you know, there's, I don't think this is treated any differently than the current program. I don't want to get in this bill to an examination of our tax structure with this kind of a program, but I think if you want to, yeah, so I would.
Next question to Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kraft. I just wanted to swing back and talk a little bit more about that $18 million. You know, so even as well-intended as the program would be to obviously help people who are in need with their energy costs, that $18 million seems like an extraordinary amount of money when you look at a percentage basis. You know, even like if I'm donating to a charity, we're told that you want the majority of that going right to the people that need it, and you want to look for organizations that are using those dollars very carefully. And if you could just explain a little bit more, I think the Minnesota taxpayers would want to know, you know, a little bit more detail on $18 million and why that would be a necessary percentage of this program.
Or Ms. Levinson-Falk, did you want to respond?
I'll start.
Okay, Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair and Representative Altendorf, I think it's an excellent question, one that I'm asking as well. The federal guidelines on this program, with the nature of it, I think are in the 10 to 15% range. This has put a little bit more in there to try to do outreach and reach some folks that haven't been there, but I think, and Ms. Levinson-Falk can comment as well, but I think, you know, we're committed to go look at that and see if there are any other efficiencies we can find.
Mr. Kelly.
So, Madam Chair, Representative, the current LIHEAP program, you know, I don't think that we would disagree that it's a significant amount of administrative cost. That is not the department. Mostly it is the service providers that are using that admin percentage. For context, we spend as much as $10 million a year on the current program as admin. The state processes 150,000 applications, including 45,000 additional requests for crisis assistance, 5,000 emergency requests for energy-related repair replacement. We do all of that for $66 per applicant. So this is a lot of folks, and it sounds like a large amount of money, but it really breaks down to a low amount of money per application. It's labor-intensive to connect with folks who are potentially either in a crisis, have never interacted with state government before, have language barriers, as Ms. Tak has described. And so last year when we had a significant amount of additional federal resources from the ARPA program, we still had trouble reaching folks to connect with them, to give them this benefit, to connect them with this benefit when they were in crisis, and that we increased the amount, the AMI, when we had those additional funds to try to get that out the door. It's gone back down to get some benefit out there. But I know that the price, there is sticker shock, but it is because it's labor intensive, and we process a ton of these applications as a cold weather state.
Thank you for that context, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you.
We've got two more people asking questions, so if we can be brief, please. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I recognize that people look at that $100 million and they think that that's a lot of money, and it is. It's a lot of money. But it's important to note that Ms. Levinson-Falk pointed out that this is for a five-year window. So $20 million a year, this is an existing program. Second point is that this is for heating assistance, and so this is something that we have done in the past. We have provided supplemental appropriations. I speak specifically, I think, specifically to 2014 when Representative Radenovich carried supplemental funding for the LIHEAP program because of the propane funding crisis. But certainly as your purview as chair, you have the opportunity with lines 3.13 to 3.23 to make some modifications and adjustments to that. I think if you look at the 2014 bill and you look at the history of administering LIHEAP programs, you will find that this, you know, every dollar that gets put into administration is one less dollar that's going to people who actually need the assistance. And I would really encourage you to give that a strong look, and maybe in addition to lowering those percentages, put some more aggressive reporting in there. There has been previously, we know of at least one group comes to mind that was actually federally indicted for corruption, and we want to make sure that there's going to be a lot of scrutiny of nonprofits going forward. I think it would be wise to have more reporting and lower dollar or lower percentage thresholds. So thank you.
Thank you for that. And I think there was some notice of interest in looking at that. And so I think that will happen. And the bill will be laid over. So I think there will be every opportunity for that. Last question, Representative Newton, before we turn it back to the author.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Garofalo got part of my question. The other part is that I'm concerned, as I was yesterday, with people who own a lot of property being able to apply for these grants. And even though the resident of the home could be a renter, it is below that poverty level or at the level, the money is actually going to benefit the person that owns the property. It's not the renter that benefits from it because the property value is going to go up. And I think it was the point that you were making yesterday on the amendment that you had. And I would like to see, if you're going to do this, that not more than one grant can be provided to any individual owning property. So if you've got a large landlord, he can only benefit from that one time.
Representative Newton, Ms. Levinson-Falk, would you like to?
Sure, I can try to be brief. Thank you, Chair Acom and Representative Newton. I think if you have a landlord owning the property, they are not eligible to benefit from it. A renter could benefit if they have the utility bills in their own name, so that would be a renter's expense. And so, like, if I'm renting a property and I have a utility bill, if I don't pay it, that's on me. Even if I move, it doesn't transfer to the landlord. But other than that, a landlord wouldn't be able to benefit from this program.
Thank you. I don't want to belabor the point, but, you know, generally speaking, the person who rents the house would have the utility bill in their name, and their income could be below that level. I just don't want to see someone who's, I have some in my area who owns 60, 70 homes, and most of them are lower income homes, that could benefit from a program like this, personally benefit by having the value of their homes increase. So I just wanted to make that point.
I appreciate that, and I think that if the utility bills are in their name, they can benefit from that. Is that right, Ms. Levinson-Falk?
Or maybe I'm missing. Chair Acom, this program doesn't make any typically doesn't make improvements to the home itself. It in most cases just pays the utility bill. So if a renter owes an electric bill, it would just pay the bill. It wouldn't be a landlord benefit.
Any final comments to our bill author, Representative Kraft?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy researched energy burden in 2020 and actually found that high energy burdens are correlated with greater risk for respiratory diseases, increased stress, and economic hardship and difficulty in moving out of poverty. So this is an important and targeted program for households who really need the assistance. And thank you.
And with that, the bill is laid over. Our final bill on the agenda today is House File 2439 with Representative Holland.
I have not actually.
Welcome to committee, Ms. Collins. Let's see, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Chair Acom. Yes, I would like to move that House File 2439 be laid over for possible inclusion.
And it appears as though there's an A1?
That is correct. It gets the bill into the format I would like it to be in.
Great. Any discussion to the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. With that, Representative Collins, would you like to tell us about 2439 as amended?
Thank you, Chair Acom. Thank you, committee members. So House File 2439 is the intervener compensation bill, and usually when I use that word, nobody knows what I'm talking about unless you've been here for a while. So I will try to explain it as much as I can for the folks who are new. This bill helps to build comprehensive records on which the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, or the PUC, can make decisions in utility proceedings. It updates existing law to allow qualifying Minnesota nonprofits, tribal governments, and Minnesota residents to receive compensation for certain costs of participating in PUC proceedings. And just so you know, as a quasi-judicial agency, the PUC can only make decisions based on the record before it. And thus, the PUC depends on a variety of parties to present evidence in every proceeding. However, it's incredibly resource intensive to participate in the proceedings, and parties representing low-income households, residential consumers, and other public interests aren't able to participate in many of the proceedings to provide necessary evidence. While the utility companies recover their costs from ratepayers for presenting their desired outcomes, there is currently no compensation for participation by non-governmental organizations who represent ratepayer interests outside of rate cases. Several things that this bill does, it limits the amount of compensation that may be paid, so it caps the amount that can be awarded to any utility in a year. And that cap does vary based on the size of the utility to ensure that compensation doesn't become a noticeable cost to ratepayers. At the absolute maximum, cost would still be less than 0.1%. So that's 3 to 5 cents per month for the average residential customer. It caps the amount that a participant can receive in a single docket at $50,000 per proceeding or $75,000 in an integrated resource plan or a contested case proceeding. And it caps the total amount that a participant can receive per year in all dockets to $200,000. I'm going to keep talking about money because that's really what this is about. I want to reiterate that the cost of the ratepayer is really minimal. We worked to make sure that it would not be noticeable to the ratepayers. That it would not cost a lot to small utilities because it is based on the amount of the utility's total annual revenue, so that regardless of the utility's size, it's not going to overly burden them, and that it only applies to public utilities as defined in statute, doesn't include municipalities or cooperative electrical associations. So I want to reiterate that if advocacy from one of these orgs or tribal government duplicates something that the Department of Commerce or the Attorney General or any other agency or participant argues in a docket, it doesn't qualify for compensation. Participants only qualify if they've made a unique contribution to the record and represented an interest that would not otherwise have been adequately represented. So I really believe that this will encourage better collaboration between nonprofits and agencies and tribal governments to get a full and complete picture of what is before the issues that are before the PUC. I know that some of the utilities and labor unions have concerns about this bill, and I want to reiterate that I am committed to continuing to work with them to get to a place where we're at least more neutral, if not more agreeable. But with that, I would like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Akam. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board. And thank you for taking up this bill and for the opportunity to speak about it. This bill updates a decades-old statute that allows qualifying participants in PUC proceedings to have reasonable costs of participation reimbursed under certain conditions. The purpose is, as Representative Holland said, to get better representation of the public interest at the PUC. As she said, the PUC is only allowed to consider what's on the record in each docket it takes up, and that means that the commissioners depend on parties to bring evidence in each proceeding that is representative of the variety of considerations that they have to weigh. But it's hard, it's time-consuming, it's expensive to participate at the PUC, and as a result, ratepayer interests, and particularly the interests of communities that are disproportionately impacted by costs and by air pollution and the other burdens of our energy system, are too often underrepresented. Existing law allows for public interest interveners to have costs of participation reimbursed in utility rate cases, and those are really important, but they only happen periodically. Sometimes a utility can go a decade or more in between rate cases. And it's not that utility charges don't increase during that time, it just happens in other types of proceedings. It happens in what's known as a rider, for example, to pay for new generation or transmission lines or distribution system investments, or even the more than $600 million in costs from the natural gas price spike during the winter storm of 2021. That was not in a rate case. So none of those proceedings are included in the current intervener's compensation statute, and neither are important dockets regarding shutoff protection or program designs or many other things. And that's why this bill is important. I won't reiterate everything that Representative Holland said in describing the bill, but I do want to just emphasize that in addition to the ways that the bill caps costs, it's not in the current law, it also raises the bar that parties have to reach in order to qualify. So it's only available to groups that provide unique contributions and whose positions are actually adopted by the PUC. There are six criteria that a participant has to show, and under the bill you have to reach all six of them. The intervention supported by this policy will save ratepayers many times its cost. Cubs work alone has contributed many millions of dollars of savings in the past few years. This bill is the result of work over the last 3 years by Cub and the Energy Sense Coalition, especially with the previous executive director, Pam Marshall. We worked with utilities, public agency staff, bipartisan legislators, and other advocates to ensure that the bill would work for everyone. Last year, Xcel and Minnesota Power testified in support, and all the utilities were comfortable with the bill, and it had bipartisan support in the legislature. The bill that's introduced this year is the negotiated language from last year. That's our starting point. LIUNA shared some concerns with the bill last biennium, but was not vocally opposed and didn't request language changes. We understand that there are now larger concerns from the trades. LIUNA recently sent us language requesting very substantial changes, and we don't have resolution on this yet, but it's an ongoing discussion. And Cub, and I think LIUNA will say the same, we're committed to working with the trades to try to find a solution. I did want to briefly address a few of the concerns that have been raised. It's been suggested to limit compensation to rate cases and integrated resource plan proceedings. Those are the 15-year plans that an electric utility does about where its generation is going to come from. However, this would miss the majority of important proceedings and even the majority of proceedings that have rate impacts. It's been suggested to treat the program as a pilot or to add a sunset so that the impact of the program changes can be evaluated. That same idea was discussed among stakeholders in the last biennium. It would be really difficult for underrepresented groups to take advantage of a program that could go away in a couple years. And groups that could use it would do it with consultants at, you know, 4 or 5 times the cost of doing it in-house. However, an evaluation of program changes, we agree, would certainly be appropriate and helpful, and that is included in the bill at Subdivision 7. We've heard criticism that compensation is likely to support organizations that already have some other sources of funding, and that is by design. To be effective at the PUC, a group needs to develop an understanding of the history of the proceedings and relationships with other parties so that you can take into those perspectives into account and work towards real solutions. Effective organizations have to be sustainable. Participant compensation can be important support so that underrepresented voices are better heard, but participants shouldn't be entirely dependent on funding from this program. But that's not how the program has worked through its long history. And finally, we've been asked if this bill could result in a host of new groups getting compensation for essentially bad arguments in PUC proceedings, and the answer is no. Under the bill, as I said, it's far harder to earn compensation than it is under current law, and arguments that are not supported by evidence or are repetitive of what another participant said or otherwise just bad arguments do not qualify for compensation. This bill is a timely and important update to bring a longstanding statute up to speed with the nature and scope of proceedings at the PUC today. It's the result of a lot of hard work among ratepayer advocates, utilities, state agencies, and legislators from both parties. And Cub will continue to work to resolve the new concerns that have been raised as we've done through past years. Thank you again for hearing this bill and for the opportunity to speak, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Levinson-Falk. I think Representative Swazinski has a question. We'll do that quickly before we move on to our other testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would Cub qualify to receive these funds?
Ms. Levinson-Falk.
Chair Akam, Representative Swazinski, yes.
Okay.
Representative. Next testifier, we have Catherine Fair, who works with Energy Sense. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Akam and members. My name is Catherine Fair. I am the current executive director of the Energy Sense Coalition. Prior to this role, I was the director of the Energy Assistance Program, as well as other programs serving individuals and families at a local community action organization for over 20 years. I believe that passing this bill would support the mission of the Energy Sense Coalition and its over 30-year history of providing advocacy exclusively for low and fixed income Minnesotans to afford their energy bills. New to my role, advocacy for affordable energy put to use my professional experience in multiple programs and work with community-based organizations, but provides the opportunity to make a difference with that experience. Also, at a personal level, I'm connected to this work. As a single parent of 4 now adult children, I've been a recipient of energy assistance, housing and child care assistance, as well as food support. As you probably know, and we've heard many statistics with the energy assistance supplement bill preceding this, Statewide, one out of four people below the poverty level in Minnesota are children. Here in Ramsey County, with a poverty rate of about 14%, two out of three of those living in poverty are people of color. Greater Minnesota has a growing percentage of low-income seniors and people with disabilities who are faced with rising energy, housing, food, health care costs while on fixed incomes. Additionally, working families everywhere are juggling child care expenses in addition to rising costs of basic necessities. Through participating in Public Utility Commission's dockets, policy and consumer advocacy at the state and local level, for over three decades, EnergySense has leveraged over $5 million in non-federal funding for low-income bill payment and conservation assistance services. The EnergySense Coalition is a relatively small nonprofit energy advocacy organization that also provides the affordability and conservation services in the East Metro to over 15,000 households. We have total staff of seven and no policy or regulatory staff except me. I'm acutely aware of the challenges of maintaining relevance in this work at the PUC, including time-consuming research, ongoing coordination with other stakeholders, maintaining an awareness of multiple utility-related dockets, and meticulous preparation of written and oral testimony. Our organization has been involved in a number of commission dockets, from the COVID pandemic service disconnection moratorium, consumer protections, bill payment assistance program, and to the implementation of the first low-income conservation program dedicated specifically to income-qualified renters and in Minneapolis. If we are compensated under the terms contemplated by this bill, we may be able to expand our policy staff capacity so that low-income utility customer experience and perspective could be offered in more dockets. This bill does constrain by the size of the organizational payroll, the regulatory and advocacy funding already available, and by docket compensation limits that expansion. And it continues to limit the compensation by effectiveness by requiring to meet the six conditions of performance to even be eligible. So we're simply requesting that organizations like ours do not have to always choose when to participate in PUC stakeholder process or proceedings or need to decline to do so because of limited resources or capacity. We think this bill takes an important step toward helping us continue to appear, participate, and influence the outcome of commission proceedings on behalf of low-income utility customers. Thank you for considering this bill, Madam Chair and members, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fair. We've got a couple more testifiers. Kevin Franis with LIUNA. And next is Alice Madden. Welcome to committee, Mr. Franis. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Akam, committee members. Try to keep it quick. I want to start by thanking, my name is Kevin Pranis. I'm here on behalf of LIUNA in Minnesota, North Dakota. And I want to start by thanking Representative Hollins and the Citizens Utility Board for their willingness to consider the concerns that LIUNA and other building trades have raised and work towards solutions. We're committed to continuing that work. Our organization appears regularly before the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission because commission decisions affect our members as workers and as ratepayers. We think the Commission is a remarkable institution that's working every day to manage our energy systems, balancing competing interests, and solving complex problems with the help of state agencies and stakeholders. In our view, Minnesota's Commission is among the most accessible and transparent agencies in state government because decisions are all made in public view and anyone can participate. You don't need to be a lawyer or an energy expert. I am not a lawyer, and I didn't really know anything about energy when I started, so it can be done. We support efforts to bring underrepresented voices into the commission process. A few years ago, we were one of those voices. We had little presence at the commission, and the commission had little understanding of the challenges facing our members or workers generally in the energy transition. And I think that's changed a lot in the last few years, and that's taking a testament to the kind of process it is. We also support the kind of advocacy that results in savings for ratepayers, especially working families, without compromising service quality. And you heard some good examples of that from Ms. Levinson-Falk and Ms. Fair. Unfortunately, we don't think the bill as currently proposed will advance either objective. First, we believe it's unlikely to bring new voices into the conversation because communities and organizations that are underrepresented and under-resourced don't have $50,000, much less $200,000, a year to spend just hoping that if they succeed, they'll get some of their money back. Instead, large intervener compensation awards are likely to go to better-financed organizations and individuals with commission experience or legal expertise. Rather than bringing in new voices, the bill risks providing a larger megaphone to groups that are starting on third base. If there are new voices, they will be voices with expertise and resources who now see the commission as a more profitable place to do business. Second, the bill is unlikely, in our view, to deliver more of the kinds of savings described by Ms. Levinson-Falk and Ms. Fair, because it is not targeted toward the rate recovery dockets most likely to deliver tangible savings for ratepayers. We already compensate interveners such as CUB in most important dockets. We also fund two public agencies to do that work. Instead, it opens up the process to dockets where the benefits to ratepayers are much less clear and the risks to ratepayers are very serious. So what kind of advocacy could be funded under the bill as currently proposed? First, trade associations representing, for example, a group of battery manufacturers could lobby to persuade the Public Utility Commission to require utilities to buy their batteries at ratepayer expense. If they were successful in that advocacy, they'd be eligible to be reimbursed. Now, we already have plenty of private advocacy happening at the commission. I don't think we need to fund that with our members' dollars or other ratepayers' dollars. Second, organizations and individuals that are already very well resourced, including some of the wealthiest nonprofits and individuals in Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic, Health Partners, and Blue Cross Blue Shield all qualify for the hardship criteria in the bill, even though they're the wealthiest nonprofits in the state, as would any individual, no matter how wealthy, as we read the stat to the bill. Next, groups and individuals whose goal is to block, delay, or increase the cost of energy projects, most of which will be wind, solar, and transmission, could also recover the cost of delays that could cost hundreds of millions of dollars. We have a solar project where a six-month delay because of concerns over cost increased the cost of the project by $100 million. So delays can be extremely costly to ratepayers, wiping out any savings that resulted from the bill. All of those organizations would also be eligible to claim intervener compensation for their work to stop these vital projects that ratepayers need. And finally, organizations and individuals whose goal is to undermine and dismantle the state's regulated utility system have been among some of the most enthusiastic supporters of intervener compensation. That's not the position of LIONO or the state building trades or the AFL-CIO and the 300,000 union members we represent. We are very concerned by efforts to dismantle the regulated utility system, similar to the concern about efforts to dismantle public schools. And we do not want to see any of our members' money or ratepayer money going to organizations to sort of try to chip away at a system that provides equal access to all. We don't fund lobbying with public dollars in Minnesota. We don't require our institutions or companies to fund lobbying either. We don't ask schools to fund parent groups to lobby for vouchers. We don't ask hospitals to fund organizations to lobby the medical board for or against abortion. And so we think the standard needs to be very high and the public interest needs to be very clear. We do look forward to working together with Representative Hollins because we think that there are good things that can be accomplished here and we hope to do that. Thank you.
And last testifier is Alice Madden. Welcome to committee. State your name for the record and proceed and try to keep your comments brief, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Alice Madden. I'm on staff at Community Power, which is a very small Minnesota-rooted organization that started a decade ago to help communities understand the energy system because it is an essential part of our lives that determines the cost of living, local pollution levels, resilience to deep freeze and heat waves, and is our lifeline to power our technology, navigation, and medical systems. We bring experience in asking and building the tool that allowed the PUC to collect video testimony during the pandemic so that Minnesotans could participate with a purposeful ripple effect of helping the PUC see how they can enable rural communities, low internet communities could participate after the peak of COVID without immense travel or technology hurdles. We are also, for the very first time, at great cost, formally intervening with a coalition of other community partners who are under-resourced as well, to fight against Xcel's huge rate increase and gathered input from over 2,000 Northside Minneapolis households that would otherwise not have attended midday WebEx or suburban public hearings. We support this bill because we know the public interest, and in particular the most energy burdened community voice, is underrepresented in PUC proceedings across the board. It's only the high profile rate cases and IRPs. It's not just there, but in the splinter dockets that hold the details. Issues like service quality, reliability, neighborhood level power grid investments, value of solar and other technologies. Rate riders were the place where the utilities tack on new fees, including from the gas price spikes, and notably the new to the PUC equity docket. It is essential that this bill has not narrowed or concentrated intervener compensation or neglected the many dockets that are flashpoints for the public interest. This need will not sunset for decades because of the depth of the problem of access, and this bill should not either. We support this bill because the public interest is currently far outmanned by one of the most well-resourced lobbying interests of the electric gas utility companies. The assault on ratepayers by utilities, funded by ratepayer dollars — we do fund lobbying with ratepayer dollars — is so great that we witness our state agencies, consumer advocates, and other interveners, including Wayuna and others, to triage the issues that they can examine and hold utilities accountable for. This bill enables additional legitimate and underrepresented stakeholders and expertise to enter the room by simply defraying, not covering, the enormous resource and time cost of doing so. We are not convinced by any of the concerns raised so far, which are primarily centered around concerns that this bill would be accessed by well-resourced groups that seek to derail public process, because those would not be granted. The PUC are a savvy bunch. There is a cap to the amount of money, and it is prioritized based on underrepresented voices and issues that have not been raised, including how recently the group received compensation and how much money they received for lobbying. I also want to just say the PUC was audited recently, and the public process is deeply flawed, and so that is why we need more and more groups to kind of piece together access to these spaces. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Now, we've got several testifiers in just a few minutes. So, Representative Swazinski?
I'll pass, Madam Chair, to get to the testifiers.
Representative, we've gotten all the testifiers.
I think, yeah, you meant...
You said testifiers.
I may be misspoke. My apologies. We have a lot of members' questions.
I'll pass. They already asked one.
Okay. Well, thank you. So, Representative Hornstein.
Hi, Madam Chair, real quick. I just want to thank you, Representative Hollins. This is an excellent bill, and I thought the last testifier, Ms. Madden, in her final comments really talked about why this is so needed. But I wanted to just share with members, I know they have this in other states, but I first became familiar with this concept, even, you know, as early as in the 1990s, when I worked for an organization called Clean Water Action, and we accessed something called the Technical Assistance Grant Program that's sponsored by the EPA, and this relates to the Superfund bill. And it allowed community groups to get grants to hire their own experts to even the playing field in discussions about Superfund. And so there is a lot of precedent for this. It's a really important concept, and I think, again, it evens the playing field and allows groups that are under-resourced to participate in really important conversations that they might not be able to otherwise. So thank you for bringing this forward. I strongly support it.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly to Representative Hollins, from the fiscal note, if you could just I was waiting for you to say this, and I didn't hear it throughout the testimony or through your discussion. So we have a fiscal note, and I'm just wondering if you could let us know, in the past 15 years, how many entities have actually requested to be paid back, how many of them were granted, and what do we think will be the progress moving forward? Like, how many more requests do you think we'll see?
Representative Holland.
Thank you, Chair Acom, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. So in the past 15 years, if you look at your if you look at your fiscal note, it has a little section in there about it. The last 15 years, there's been 7 requests for intervener compensation, and 6 of them have been from the same entity. The 7th was from an individual, and it was denied. The understanding is that they don't know how many more that this would increase it by. I think that it is at least somewhat safe to say that it's not going to be a huge number, because this is really technical and strange, and honest to God, I didn't even know the PUC existed before I came to the legislature. So the expectation that there's just like this plethora of individuals who are waiting to get before the PUC and argue their case, I think is extremely unlikely, but my understanding is that currently we don't have an idea of what this will bring or how many more people would be involved.
Brief follow-up for them?
Yep, just really quickly. So the fiscal note does go on, and I'll just help you out because I just figured you'd let us know, but it was they anticipate 3 additional requests per year, and so instead of 7 in 15 years, 3. So they have an FTE of a quarter person, and they believe that's enough. But, again, they don't know, so we don't know. Hopefully in a year from now, if this passes and goes into law, we'll actually have a follow-up. And so I hope, Representative Hollins, you'll bring this back in a year and tell us what happened.
Representative Altenburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins. I just wanted to speak a little bit to the question that Representative Zielinski asked and then also the testifier, you know, that these funds would be available or to organizations like CUB, Mayo, Health Partners. And my questions to you, did you know that, number one? And then number two, now that that's clearly spoken, is this what we want the bill to do, and can we change, can we tighten that up? Because as you're saying, you don't know how many additional people are going to be getting that money, but these are large organizations that would have paid employees that could just particularly go after that money.
And I just want to also clarify that the money that people are going to the PUC to try and stop, they are saving ratepayers millions and millions of dollars in oftentimes. So anyway, I will turn it over to Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Altendorf. So I appreciate you asking this question because I was actually communicating with Ms. Levinson-Falk here, and she wanted to take on this question because listening to the testimony, it was a little unclear, and so I would turn it, if you would.
Ms. Levinson-Falk.
I can't turn it over to
thank
her.
You, Chair Akam. Representative Altendorf, yeah, this is one of the topics that CUB and LIUNA have been discussing. I think they did identify potentially a loophole in the financial hardship standard. This is not supposed to be serving the Mayo Clinic or Health Partners, and certainly CUB is. Well, we like to think that we're pretty cool. We're nowhere near that size. So we would like to address that, and we're working on that. Okay. To the point about trade associations are typically organized as a 501c6. They are not qualified under this bill, so you can't come and represent your business organization with this.
Thank you. Yep. No, I appreciate the answer, and I just hope we close that. That would just be unfortunate. Thank you.
I appreciate the openness for that. Final question to Representative Kraft.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hollins. Thank you for bringing this bill. I think the last testifier and some of the questions raised a really interesting point, and that is I wonder if you know or if we can know as part of this how much money the regulated utilities in the state do spend on lobbying and compared to this. And then that may be an area to look into. Maybe that we should be requiring some balance in the amount of money that is spent on lobbying and that kind. So I think it's a really interesting question.
Yes, let's even the playing field. That would be great. Let's do that.
Yeah. Final comments from Representative Collins on the bill?
Thank you, Chair Akam, and thank you, Representative Kraft, for that question. I think that would be that's an interesting topic, and we could certainly get into that. But I will do closing comments because I see the chair looking at me like, don't do that. The one thing I did want to say is one of my primary concerns on this is that it is difficult to put that money on the front end and expect a reimbursement. I would love to do a pot of money where we could just fund people who are bringing that forward, but I'm guessing that this body would not love that. And so this is really the closest that we can get is trying to allow people the opportunity to invest in this and to prepare and present a present their stance on something, and if it does meet these criteria, which are pretty high, then they could be compensated. I just want to note that without this bill, the PUC has to make decisions based on an incomplete record, and it will bring balance. This bill can bring balanced evidence to bear in important utility policymaking considerations. As Ms. Levinson-Falk pointed out, this statute was updated 16 years ago, and it's due for an update to align with our increasing scope and the variety of PUC proceedings. So with that, I would encourage a yes vote.
Thank you, and I appreciate the willingness to continue to work on this bill. And with that, it is laid over. Thank you. And the meeting is adjourned.